Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is a bi-monthly digest of original crime and mystery fiction. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Our podcast series features authors reading their stories, often from our back issues, but for this episode, Deborah H. Goldstein reads her story, The Night They Burned Miss Dixie's Place, from our May-June 2017 issue. This story was nominated for an Agatha and an Anthony Award for Best Short Story. Deborah read her story while at the Malice Domestic Convention in Bethesda, Maryland. A graduate of the University of Michigan, where her first book, Maze in Blue, is set, and of Emory University School of Law, Deborah is a former U.S. Administrative Law Judge in Birmingham, Alabama. After the reading, Deborah talks about her new series forthcoming from Kensington, beginning with One Taste Too Many, and about how the game of Mahjong was used to structure her second mystery, Should Have Played Poker.
I remember the night they burned Miss Dixie's place. The newspapers reported it was an incendiary, but the only hot thing that night was Miss Dixie. Folks who aren't from around these parts chalk it up to being another story from the civil rights era. Not as moving as those four little girls killed in the church that got bombed over on 16th Street, or as scary as when they blew out the walls of Reverend Shuttleworth's house. There weren't any men in hoods slinking around that night, and Bo Connor and those dogs the Yankees saw on TV were all sleeping in their respective beds. What started everything was her belief that she was entitled to run her business the way she wanted. There aren't too many left in this world who heard her that night. For me, it was the first time I met Dixie Davis. She gave me a nickel. I was 9 years old and always looking for a way to make a penny or a nickel. As an extra job, my mom cleaned rooms at one of Miss Dixie's places at night. Miss Dixie insisted, unlike that motel on First Avenue, that beds be changed any time a room got a new customer. Most nights, my mom left me with my grandmother, but when Nana couldn't watch me, Mom would take me along and tell me to sit quietly in the kitchen until she was done working. I was lying in the corner on the linoleum floor, trying to catch a bit of any summer breeze that might come through the screen door, when Miss Dixie came into the kitchen. From where I lay, I had to crane my neck up to see where a red, yellow, and green bandana that matched her muumuu dress covered a shade of pink hair that I'd never seen on a woman before. She had her back to me as she ran water in the sink and washed her hands. Then she grabbed a glass from the drain board and filled it with water from the tap before sitting down at the wooden kitchen table. She took a long sip, put her glass down on the table, glanced at the clock on the wall across from her, and rested her head on her hands. I didn't think she'd noticed me because I was laying on the floor behind her, so I jumped a mile when she said, "What are you staring at, boy?" When I didn't reply, she turned her fixed her eyes on me. I jumped to my feet, but I still didn't say anything. "Cat got your tongue, boy?" "No, ma'am. Just don't have nothing to say." She laughed. "That's not a bad way to be. Wish more men knew how to keep their mouths shut when they don't have anything to say. Come here, boy." I did what I was told. Stood there and let her look me up and down. She didn't have to tell me who she was. I knew from the way she carried herself and seemed to own the room and everything in it, including me, that she was Mama's boss, Miss Dixie. "You Maisie's boy?" "Yes, ma'am," I said. But then I was worried my being there was going to get Mama in trouble. Nana couldn't watch me tonight. I promised not to get in the way. "Oh, you won't. I can assure you of that. How old are you, boy?" 9. She raised her eyebrow. I noticed that even though her makeup was on pretty heavy, I could see wrinkles in her forehead. "Mama says I'm small for my size, but I'm strong and..." I stopped talking, thinking Mama wouldn't want me going on and on with her boss. "And what?" "And I'm a pretty good reader." I stood up a little straighter and stuck my chest out. She smiled. Then she reached across the table for a book I hadn't noticed was there. "Think you can read me a few pages from this book?" I took the book from her, and for a moment our fingers touched. I felt a shock tingle up my arm. "Static electricity," she said. I nodded and looked down at the book I now was holding. It was a Bible. "Do you have a favorite part?" I asked. "Read me the part where the marker is." I started reading the portion she'd marked, the one that talks about a woman of worth. She stopped me after a few lines and took the Bible back from me. For a minute she looked real sad, and then she laughed again. But this time it sounded forced to me. She slipped a hand into her pocket and brought out a leather change purse that she rummaged in until she found the coin she wanted. "Here's a nickel for your reading." I pocketed it before she changed her mind. Miss Dixie laughed again. This time it sounded real. "You keep reading and you'll be able to learn a lot more nickels." "Did you earn this one reading the Bible?" "Not quite." I don't know if I made a face or what, but Miss Dixie grabbed my shoulder and pulled me square in front of her. My face was so close to hers that I could see little beads of sweat on her forehead. I stood there trying not to flinch from the pressure of her fingers pushing into my skin. Instead, I concentrated on the soft scent of her lilac toilet water. She was about to say something else, but my mother came rushing into the kitchen. Mama stopped short, just beyond the stove. Her hair was disheveled, and she couldn't seem to leave the edge of her apron alone as her eyes jumped from Miss Dixie's hands to me and back to Miss Dixie's face. "I'm sorry. I didn't have anyone to leave him with tonight." Mama wiped her hands on her apron. I hadn't noticed how chapped they were. Miss Dixie nodded and released my shoulders. I took a step back, out of her reach. "Did you come in here to check on your boy, or do you need me for something?" "To find you," Mama said, ignoring me. "We have a problem in the big room upstairs." "Can't you get a few of the girls together to help send the problem on its way, so you can clean up?" Mama shook her head. She seemed pale and a little short of breath. I stepped forward to help her sit down at the table with Miss Dixie, but she waved me away. "It's not something I can take care of. I saw Lily go in, but she turned around and hightailed it downstairs. Figured the room was empty, so I was going to slip in and tidy up, but I knocked just in case. Nobody answered, so I went in with a stack of clean sheets. There was a gent still resting in the bed. I started to back out real quietly, and then I saw a red stain spreading across the blanket. I made myself look again. He'd been stabbed." Miss Dixie stood up and put her arm around my mother. "How do you know he was stabbed?" "There's a knife still sticking straight out of him." "What did you do then, Maisie?" "I dropped my sheets and bit my tongue so I wouldn't scream. I knew I needed to find you." Miss Dixie's eyes opened wider. "Don't worry," Mama said. "I closed the door tight to make it seem like someone is using the big room before I started looking for you." Mama raised her head so their eyes locked. "When I didn't see you upstairs or in the parlor, I thought you might be here." "It's Mr. Johnny, ma'am." "Mr. Johnny?" Miss Dixie repeated, letting go of Mama. "Yes, ma'am, Mr. Johnny." I was surprised. Mama didn't have to say anything else. Even I knew who Mr. Johnny was. A bigwig at one of the banks and a friend of most of the city's politicians. Mr. Johnny's picture was always in the newspaper. A few months ago, I'd actually seen pictures of Miss Dixie and Mr. Johnny on the same page. The article said he was spearheading an effort to clean up our city, and he wanted to start with the street Miss Dixie's house was on. I'd read the article, and I didn't know what he had against her place. It always seemed to me that everyone was welcome there. But Mr. Johnny apparently said, if necessary, everything on the block should be burned. Miss Dixie answered with some none-too-choice remarks that the paper didn't think it should print. I didn't understand the whole article, but there was no denying Mr. Johnny and Miss Dixie were both boiling mad. Guess they'd made up. Mr. Johnny got here about 7 with some of his friends. They all know he took the big room, Mama said. So they'll remember where he was when he doesn't come home. If he's hurt, maybe his friends can help him, I started to say, but Mama held her hand up and gave me that look that shuts me up. I decided to get out of their way by sitting down in the corner of the kitchen with my back to the wall. What are you going to do? Mama asked. There isn't much I can do except work on emptying this place and then give Mr. Johnny what he wanted on the street. Mama nodded. Miss Dixie pushed her bandana back. When she brought her hand down, She must have noticed some dirt on it because Miss Dixie went over to the sink and washed her hands again. She patted her hands dry on a towel and then used the same towel to dab at her face. "Boy," she said to me, "there's some kindling and wood on the back porch out there. I want you to bring it in for me." "Isn't it too hot for a fire?" "It's never too hot for a roaring fire. Bring that wood into the kitchen and then you scurry on home. Your mother will be along shortly." I shrugged and glanced at Mama. She nodded and shooed me with her hand. I hurried to do their bidding and then to get out of there while it was still light. It was the first time my mother was letting me walk home alone, and even though it didn't get dark until late, I thought it would be a good idea to move before the sun went down. Mama didn't come home until a couple of hours after me. By then it was dark, which made it easier for us to stand on our porch and see the sparks and flames coming from the direction of Miss Dixie's house. We didn't say anything to each other. We simply watched. A couple of days later, I saw a picture in the newspaper of the burning house and one of Miss Dixie covered in soot from trying to help put out the fire. The article that ran with the picture said someone had thrown a firebomb through the front window. No one knew why. The police thought it was probably a nut or someone crazed by the summer heat. The fire department was reported as saying they were called too late. The responders tried to put out the blaze, but couldn't save the house or its contents. There was no mention of Mr. Johnny, except to say the paper unsuccessfully tried to interview him. In the next few weeks, there were a few news stories about nobody being able to locate Mr. Johnny, but the story faded away like him. Mama never worked for Miss Dixie again. She said her day job now paid well enough to keep food on our table and a roof over our heads. I believed her. Mama and Miss Dixie are gone, and Birmingham is a lot different city, but it's my home. I found my niche that night. I've been working as an arson inspector for the past 25 years.
That was Deborah H. Goldstein reading her story, The Night They Burned Miss Dixie's Place, from the May-June 2018 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. We recorded this reading during the Malice Domestic Mystery Conference in May 2018.
I like Mahjong.
After she read the story, Deborah talked for a bit
now,
about her writing.
I didn't play for over 30 years. I grew up with my mother being a Mahjong player. And I can remember an evening a week or while the kids were in camp, at the summer camps, the mothers would play to have entertain themselves. And I enjoyed the game because you kind of learn by osmosis. But I never really played till the last couple of years. To me, I write with it because I started writing because Mahjong players are hilarious. Think most of these women have played like my mother's game. They must have played for 30, 40 years together. These are women who you'd never think would be buddies, but they know each other's behavior. They know each other's foils, and they put up with each other. They may think one's a bravado, and they may think one's the biggest liar in the world, but they're going to put up with it because she's their Mahjong player. When I wrote Should Have Played Poker, a Carrie Martin and the Mahjong Player mystery, I used characters that I'd taken from a short story, Legal Magic, and they were the Mahjong players. And they were exactly my mother's friends, but don't tell them. But they were the women who have gone from playing when their kids were just born and they needed something to divert themselves, playing as they worked and they needed something just one night out, please give me 3 hours out, playing when they retired, and now moving from their homes to their retirement villages together. So that, I used it as a structure. It's not the basis of the book. But the game itself, from how you pass, how you play the tiles, and I guess for anybody who doesn't understand Mahjong, you can compare it to a card game in some ways. You have tiles in front of you like you would have in a Scrabble board. You have 13 and a 14th tile that's always pulling up and is the twist tile. But you also have a card in front of you with 55 hands roughly on it, if you're playing one of the Americanized versions. And you have to get your tiles in front of you to match one of those hands. So you're either playing to match a hand or you realize there's no hand you're going to get, so you better play defensively because you don't really want to lose your 25 cents or whatever it is. We play for money, but don't tell anybody because that's considered gambling and we play in a public place. But anyway, that is the thing. So it's a defensive game. And some people's minds are so great that they can look around, and it's just like card players who know they can count it almost. And there are others who just play spontaneously. So it's a lot of fun to see how the different people interact. And that's part of the game. You have serious players who you wouldn't say a word while the game's going on. And you have others that you laugh all the way through. I think I tend to be one of those. Thanks for asking about my new book. It comes out December 18th in the stores, and it's called One Taste Too Many. It's from Kensington. And in it, the protagonist, you might say, is Sarah Blair. And for a culinary challenge, Sarah Blair, there's only one thing scarier than cooking from scratch, and that's murder. She was married at 18, divorced at 28, and Sarah Blair reluctantly swaps her luxury lifestyle for a cramped studio apartment and a law receptionist job in the tired hometown she never left. With nothing much to show for the last decade but her feisty Siamese cat, Rara, and some clumsy domestic skills, she's the polar opposite of her bubbly twin, Emily, an ambitious chef determined to take her culinary ambitions to the top at her local gourmet restaurant. But Sarah knew that things were getting a little messy. Things for her start falling apart when her ex drops dead, seemingly poisoned by Emily's award-winning rhubarb crisp. Now, with Rara wanted by the woman who broke up her marriage and Emily wanted by the police for murder, Sarah needs to figure out the right recipe to crack the case before time runs out. Unfortunately, for a gal whose idea of good china is floral paper plates, catching the real killer and living to tell about it could mean facing a fate worse than death, being in the kitchen.
Thank you, Deborah, and congratulations. That was Deborah H. Goldstein reading her story, The Night They Burned Miss Dixie's Place, from the May-June 2017 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. We recorded the story during the Malice Domestic Mystery Conference in May 2017. After she read the story, Deborah talked for a bit about her writing. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. We're published by Dell Magazines and Penny Publications. To learn more about us, you can go to our website, alfredhitchcockmysterymagazine.com, or look for us on Facebook, or on our blog, traceevidence.net. That's trace-evidence.net. You can find the magazine at your newsstand, and digital editions are available at all major e-tailers. This podcast was produced with the help of Jackie Sherbo and Deanna McLafferty. We hope you enjoyed it.